And good evening and welcome to another edition of Bird Calls from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And tonight's program is going to sound a bit different as we are all socially distancing again here at Red River Radio. So Cliff Shackelford is home in Nacogdoches, and I'm home here in Shreveport. Troy Jones is manning the controls at the station, and Wally Derleth is way across the other side of the station at the phone bank. We ask that when you call in tonight, please be patient, as we only have one phone volunteer, Wally, and he may have his hands full for a time. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he's ready to answer your questions about birds and birding tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book, Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored more than 80 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, thanks for joining us tonight. How are you doing down there in Nacogdoches?
Oh, hot and toasty, that's for sure.
I'm telling you, that heat out there drained my battery on my truck, so that's why I'm stuck at home here. It's clicking, but it ain't running. So once again, we invite everybody to call in tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you have a photo to send to Cliff to identify during the show, you can send it to my email address at wbeckett, that's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T, at lsus.edu. wbeckett@lsus.edu. We may not get to them tonight, but we will save them for the next show if we don't. All right, Cliff, at the end of last month's program, you gave us a conservation tip. And can you refresh our memories as we begin this week's program?
Yeah, we ended last month with a tip about providing water beyond a bird bath in more of a pond setting, something larger than a bird bath. So backyard ponds, rural ponds, and out west we call them guzzlers. Sometimes we have water tanks. Things with steep sides can be a death trap for birds and other wildlife. They're attracted to the water, they need a drink, they might fall in and they can never get out. So our tip was to, if you have a condition like that, the tip was to provide some sort of makeshift escape ladder in your pond or your guzzler or your water tank so wildlife can get out. And because I don't think anybody wants to see critters dying in this manner. So we have a backyard pond, and we have two different ways for critters to get out because they do have steep sides. We have a rock pile underwater, and critters can walk out on this rock pile. So the bottom of the pile is kind of pyramid shaped, if you think about it. So the bottom row of rocks is bigger than the next row and bigger than the next row. And so it eventually gets to a peak where critters can get out. We also have a limb inside our pond where if something swims to it, they can crawl out that way. So don't let your water source become a death trap to wildlife, especially birds. Make an escape ladder. Swimming pools are a big killer. And I certainly don't expect people to put a rock pile or a limb in their pool, but this is maybe a time to be creative. I haven't searched on the internet if someone has figured that out, but do a little homework if you have a backyard pool that you find dead critters in. Figure out a cool way, a neat way to create an escape ladder so you're not unknowingly and killing wildlife. It's not the way to go. So providing water is critical, but that's for drinking and bathing. And this time of the year, when it's this hot, water is critical. Everybody wants to put food out. I think water is more key. Birds not only need it for drinking, but they use it to bathe. Many birds are very meticulous about keeping their feathers in good shape. So provide water in that bird bath or that pond, not only for birds to drink, but also to take a bath to keep their feathers in prime condition so they can fly.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any call regarding the avian world or birding are welcome. And if you have photos to send to us, please send them to my email address. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. And also audio recordings. We do love audio recordings and they help us identify birds quite nicely. All right, Cliff, we do a profile species every month. Would you like to tell us about the loggerhead shrike?
Yeah, we're going to talk about the loggerhead shrike, also known as the butcher bird. It's not a musical songbird. We have two commonly heard examples to play of the shrike. The first is the buzzy call note that we'll hear now. Again, not very musical. And next for the loggerhead shrike, we have the longer song that's not in the least bit musical and sounds more like hiccups and can be heard here. Little hiccups. So again, two examples that are commonly heard from the shrike. And as you heard, it neither one is very musical at all. So the reason the colloquial name for this bird is butcher bird, it's for its fondness for impaling prey items to barbed wire fences, thorny shrubs or trees, or even the spine tip leaves of a yucca. Quite gruesomely, sometimes prey items are impaled while still barely alive and kicking. Even though the shrike has a fondness for smaller prey, there are published accounts of the shrike capturing, killing, and impaling other birds its own size, including cardinals. Typical prey involves critters found in and around grasslands and pastures, especially grasshoppers, beetles, and lizards. They will also hunt where a pond or creek abuts a field because one can find small frogs and crayfish impaled to the nearby fence line. So the next time you see an insect or other small animal stuck to a barbed wire fence, it's not the neighbor's kids doing it. It's likely this bird known as the loggerhead shrike. There are three general beliefs as to why shrikes impale prey. One is for caching in order to save the item to eat later. Another is for males to demonstrate to a hopeful mate that he's an excellent hunter and easily would provide food to their hungry nestlings. And the final reason is to show other shrikes that this territory is taken. This latter reason suggests that the prey is like a neon sign saying, "No vacancy here." Some observers think the shrike looks like a mockingbird because they're about the same size and both share gray and white plumage, but the shrike has a noticeable black Zorro mask plus black in the wings. The sexes look identical in the shrike, so we cannot tell readily the male shrikes from the females in the field. The shrike has strong feet and a stubby bill with a sharp hook at the tip, perfect for dispatching prey and when hungry for dismembering and consuming prey. Small songbirds must keep a watchful eye out for hawks and falcons as feathered predators around them, but they should also keep an eye out on the nearby shrikes. The modifier loggerhead refers to something that appears to have a big head on a small body, but just about all the shrikes in the world have this same appearance. Since the loggerhead shrike prefers open grasslands with native grasses and forbs, It has experienced a tremendous continental decline in the U.S., like so many other species occurring in this same habitat, including northern bobwhite and eastern meadowlark. In Canada, the loggerhead shrike has almost been extirpated, and some biologists there have discussed reintroduction efforts where local extirpations have occurred. To see a photo of a loggerhead shrike snapped by James Childress, please visit the Bird Calls page at redriverradio.org.
All right, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight. We have all lines open right now at 800-552-8502. Oh, I lied. We do not have all lines open. We're going to go right to a call right away. Carolyn from Marshall, you are on with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question tonight?
Hi, this is Carolyn, and I had a question about the bird bath.
Okay.
Do we need to dump the water out every so often?
Or yes.
How often do we need to dump it out so we don't get mosquitoes growing in it?
Yeah, great question, Carolyn. I should mention that when we provide water, we should try to replace it every other day or so. In our case, in our backyard bird bath, it has two things going against it as far as maintaining water. It has a slow leak, and when a blue jay or brown thrasher gets in it, they kick out so much of the water that we have to go refill it. So I'm kind of glad it has the leak, because you don't want that water to sit and fester. So that's great that you brought that up, Caroline. So if you have a bird bath that isn't used by these larger birds that are kicking out the water, then go out every other day. And it could be daily that you go out, because we're only talking about, you know, 1 or 2 gallons of water in a typical bird bath. But yes, make sure the water doesn't get funky and green and nasty. And so that's another reason that I like to replace the water every day or every other day. My wife, too, is because it never gets nasty and dirty and stinky and algae ridden. So, yes, I'm glad you brought that up, Carolyn. Keep the water fresh and clean. Thank you.
Thank you, Cliff.
All right. Thank you very much, Carolyn. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. And we ask that you call in tonight with your questions about bird or birding at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you would like to follow along on our website right now, we have some bird photos that we're going to be discussing here at Red River Radio. And the first one is from Dave Madden from Minden, who wrote to tell us about something that happened over there. He has 12 Mississippi kites that have just shown up. And this email came in about 3 weeks ago. And he says they're quite beautiful, and he just spent the afternoon watching them glide on the thermals. So is this the time for kites to be in this area, Cliff?
Yeah, they start returning in the spring. They don't overwinter with us. What's really neat about Mississippi kites is they all depart the U.S. They head south into South America to winter, and then they come back in the spring and breed here and summer with us. And pretty soon we're going to start seeing numbers really jack up in August and September when more northerly birds start heading south and kind of take their time and what we call staging in areas instead of just beelining for the wintering grounds. They kind of take their time. But yeah, there's going to be a lot of kites nesting in the listening area. They're very common in the southeast U.S. They're in the Great Plains, and they are increasing in other parts of the country. And so you can see a lot of Mississippi kites. A great spot would be anywhere really along the Red River, especially in the whole stretch that occurs in Texas. And then when it gets into Louisiana and right there in Shreveport and Bossier area, there are lots of Mississippi kites. This is the really pointy winged, longish tailed raptor that's not large. It's very slender and just floats around effortlessly on the wing, doesn't do a whole lot of flapping. All of a sudden you'll see it fold its wings and dive, and it's It's going after aerial insects like dragonflies and grasshoppers and moths and things that we really can't see with the naked eye from the ground, but those birds can see from above, and they're catching and eating on the wing these insects. So that's pretty neat that we had that sighting come in. And so I would encourage people to go out and look for the raptor that I just described, and it's called the Mississippi kite.
All right. And hopefully they'll eat all the mosquitoes and we won't have that problem. Somehow I doubt that.
Yeah, they're not after mosquitoes. So.
That's unfortunate. We need more birds that eat mosquitoes.
Yep, that's for sure.
All right. And we have a couple of photos from Keith Ellinger of Mississippi or of Sulphur Springs, Sulphur, Louisiana. And one of those images he has up, and it says he looks like a bald male cardinal. Immature, he questions. Mutant, he questions.
Yeah.
So what is that, Cliff? And folks who would like to follow on can follow along on our Facebook page right now.
Yeah, this
on our website, I should say.
Okay, this is probably the number one call that biologists get about birds that look like they have some sort of disease or infestation of some sort, because number one, we have so many cardinals and they're usually right at outside our windows, so we see them. They're so detectable, they're so noticeable. And in the summer months is when they'll molt. And so what people are observing is not anything unusual. There's no foul play involved. It's just the standard molt where feathers are replaced, and birds have what we call feather tracts, tracts, T-R-A-C-T. And it's the capital tract. It's the head tract. All the feathers fall off pretty much at once. And that's why they look bald for a short period. They're pretty darn ugly, I'll have to say. But just be patient. The new feathers are coming in, and within a couple, 3 weeks or so, that cardinal will be feathered again, and there's nothing to worry about. It's just a typical time of the year for cardinals to molt. And actually, all our birds molt. We just don't often see it happening. It's usually it's usually a gradual thing. But with the cardinal, they typically drop all their head feathers pretty quickly, and they can look pretty gnarly for a while. And but if you watch your cardinal when he's bald, you got to also see, what is he doing? Is he still coming to the feeder? Is he still taking a bath? He's still behaviorally doing the things that cardinals do. He doesn't look sick. You know, a sick bird is going to sit in the corner with his eyes closed, and he's just going to look rough and tough like we do when we're sick. We don't look our best, but the cardinal is doing everything normal. It's just he's lost his feathers, and feathers wear and tear, and they have to be replaced once or twice a year, depending on the species. And again, the summer months is when the cardinals lose their capital tract, and that's their head feathers, and they just look gnarly like a naked-headed vulture. But all is well. It's a normal phenomenon.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And any photo that you would like to send or audio clip that you would like to send for Cliff to identify, you can send that to wbeckett@lsus.edu. That's wbeckett@lsus.edu. And we have another caller online, Steve from Plano, Texas. Steve, what is your question tonight? You're on with Cliff.
Hi, Cliff. I enjoy your show. And my question tonight is about Cooper's hawks. Uh-huh. We've got a nest in our neighbor's backyard, and it looks like mm-hmm. they've got several fledglings. And we're just wondering what can we expect? Are they going to hang around, or kind of what can you tell us about Cooper's hawks? We've seen red tails before, but have not seen Cooper's hawks before.
Well, I would love to have a Cooper's hawk in my backyard or my neighbor's backyard, because I would love to be able to have that National Geographic moment of watching. And the moment plural, you have days and days and weeks of watching the nest. The thing that shocks a lot of people is that Cooper's hawks are primarily bird eaters. So that usually upsets some people that don't want to see their robin or their blue jay or their cardinal become the Cooper's hawk's lunch. So as long as you're cool with that, because guess what? Cooper's hawk, that's what they've been doing for millennia. They're going to keep doing it. They're not interested in changing and becoming a vegetarian and eating salad and oak leaves. They're going to stick to eating other birds that they catch on the wing. But the neat thing is they should be very vocal, and maybe that's already done when the adults are courting. Steve, did you get to hear them? Were they doing their kick? They're pretty noisy. I'm just curious if you got to hear them maybe weeks ago.
We did hear them a few weeks ago, and actually that plus, seeing them fly around and noticing them in the tree in the yard next to us is what caught our attention.
Yeah, and they're doing really well in urban settings because of columbids. Columbids are doves and pigeons. So with the increase in white-winged doves and Eurasian collared doves, and already there are mourning doves and pigeons, Cooper's hawks love columbids, all the doves and pigeons out there. So because the urban areas attract a lot of doves and pigeons, there come the things that follow. And that's the predators, and the Cooper's hawk is a really good predator on doves and pigeons. They're pretty secretive nesters, so that's really cool that you found the nest. They're kind of like Batman. They don't want you to know where the bat cave is, so they might be cackling a lot, but they kind of sneak in and out of the nest. But heck, maybe in a neighborhood like you've got, maybe they're not as secretive, but the ones out in the field, in the woods, They're really tough. They slip in and out quietly. They don't want anybody to know where the bat cave is. They don't typically fly straight to the nest. They'll fly close-ish to the nest and look around, make sure no one's watching, and then go to the nest with a food item or when it's time to change duties on the eggs, when it's incubation period and so forth. But all that, again, is just a really cool new National Geographic moments of just watching, and especially right now where we're all, many of us are staying home. We have more time on our hands to connect with nature. So, Steve, I'm super jealous that you've got a Cooper's hawk nest in the neighborhood, because I don't have one in mine. I sure would like to have one. So what you can expect, I guess, is probably what – I don't know what stage that your nest is in. Have you seen any fuzzy-headed babies sticking their heads over the edge of the nest yet?
Oh, yeah. Actually, we have. They have been out on the tree limbs and, look like they're getting close to, attempting to fly.
Cool.
But, we can see the parents, bringing some food back. We can't quite tell what it is, but we have seen them out on the limbs a few times.
Yeah. That's neat. That's called branching. A lot of raptors do that. They won't necessarily leave the nest tree, but they'll leave the nest proper and walk out on a limb, get out where they can spread their wings and flap and strengthen their muscles. Later on, they'll even make a hop or a short glide from limb to limb or tree to tree, but they'll usually come back to the nest until purely fledging, truly fledging, and that's typically going to happen when they're probably about 4 or 5 weeks old, and then they probably won't come back to the nest much after that. The nest is pretty much for the little guys, and once a raptor is ready to go, they don't come back to the nest. They might stay near it. There's some familiarization. They know that food is coming to that nest, so they might stick around, but once they fledge, you should know it, and you should be able to enjoy them for a little bit longer. But they're like the kids at age 18 or 20. They're gonna fly and leave the roost and be done and gone. And so hopefully you're okay with the grandkids leaving the nest here pretty soon, Steve.
Will the parents stick around?
They should, although Cooper's hawks aren't really year-round, that the individuals aren't typically year-round in a certain spot. So we will have Cooper's hawks as a species year-round in an area, but that doesn't mean the individual is. So those two that have set up shop and bred there, they're probably not going to winter there. They're probably going to leave sometime soon. And so whether they come back next year is another question. And whether they use the same nest, typically raptors will build a new nest, especially excipiters, because the stuff they use, the material they use over the, you know, the next year will get pretty rotten and soft and nasty and hold in water. And so they usually typically make new nests every year. So if they come back, your ears are going to be your best detector for that bird. You can see Cooper's hawks pretty well, but boy, when they start doing their there's no one else that sounds like that out there, and that can usually lead you to a breeding pair. And then from there, it's just a matter of luck to find the nest. So that's really cool, Steve, that you've got that, and hopefully you can watch the rest of the nesting cycle.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for the information. Yeah. Again, enjoy
Great.
Your show.
Thank you, Steve.
And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open, so you'll get right in right now. And in the meantime, Keith Ellender, also from Sulphur again, sent in another photograph. And this time, guess what? He thought it was of a Cooper's hawk. So you can follow us online right now at redriverradio.org on the post for tonight's show. And you would be able to see exactly what he's talking about. Cliff, what do you think about that photograph?
Yeah, that's not a Cooper's hawk. So he thought it was, but it's a stockier bird with heavier legs. And it's not the greatest picture, but to me, it's a broad-winged, spot-on broad-winged hawk adult. It's got the right tail, the right body shape, the thick legs. And so I think he's got a broad-winged hawk, which is another bird that summers with us but doesn't spend the winter with us. They are highly migratory. We have broad-winged hawks come in our yard about this time of the year when the cicadas are getting really pumped up and noisy. Some people colloquially call cicadas locusts. They're not locusts. A locust is a grasshopper, typically when they get into large numbers. But the cicada is that noisy bird on the hot summer day that you hear across a lot of the country. There's many, many species of cicadas. And even in East Texas, there are more than one species. I'm not an entomologist. I don't know all the different ones, but the broadwings love cicadas. They're walking the limbs. You can hear when they catch one because the cicada is fussing, making a lot of ruckus trying to get away. But I guess they must taste good because a lot of critters eat them. The Mississippi kite we talked about earlier, they eat cicadas as well.
All right. And I guess good meat sandwich there for them,
I guess.
With the cicadas. So
yeah.
Now I like those little buzzies, but they end up dying all over the parking lot here, and you end up seeing their exoskeletons all over the place.
Yeah. And a lot of these winged insects, a lot of birds that eat them, like dragonflies and cicadas, they typically pluck the wings off. And that's more for getting it down their gullet. And because if you think about a dragonfly, it's like sending the letter X down your throat. And so you got to get rid of those wings. And then it becomes just like a straw, and it goes down the gullet a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So and the wings are typically there's nothing worth digesting on a wing. It's not very fleshy. And so you'll see these birds, if you watch them, they're pulling the wings off of dragonflies and cicadas and eating the thorax and the abdomen and the head. So the rest of the body, but just not the wings.
Sounds like people eating crawfish.
Actually it is. It is. And taking the shrimp tails off, it's the same thing. Yeah.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and all lines are open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And again, if you have any photo or sound recording of a bird, you can send that to my email address at wbeckett, that's W-B-E-C-K-E-T-T at lsus.edu. Again, that's lsus.edu. And we're going to go for one more question that was sent in online. No photo with this. But Brian L. Hawk was biking around Bossier City and wrote, "I'm not an avid birder or anything, but just an FYI, while biking around my neighborhood, I noted some odd bird calls, then spotted some strange birds, nine-ish of them, on a roof of a couple of houses in North Bossier, specifically this street on the southeast side. After researching, I'd never seen or heard anything like these before. Most of my life, he is local there. Had a guess from a relative as a whistling duck, but noted a slight coloration into their bills. I'm fairly certain I can confirm that they are black-bellied whistling ducks. Do you have any comments? You've seen the video and you've seen the question. What do you think there, Cliff?
Yeah, he provided a video that he found online. He didn't snap or film that, but it matches up what he described. I've got no problems with how he described the bird and identified it by himself, which is really cool. And black-billed whistling duck is certainly likely. They've expanded their range northward out of South Texas over the past several decades. They're cavity nesters, so they do really well using duck boxes that are mounted for wood ducks. That's helped their expansion. They like free handouts, so you'll see a lot of whistling ducks in South Texas and Central Texas and along the coast coming to automatic corn feeders for deer and or people that throw out deer corn or crack corn in their yard. Black-bellied whistling ducks will come in by the 20s and 30s sometimes in these areas. I've never seen that many in away from those aforementioned areas, but I definitely have seen black-bellied whistling ducks in some numbers, and they're expanding. They have these bright reddish pink bills and legs. The most noticeable thing are the black and white wings that are striking when they fly, and they make a whistling sound, and that's where they get the name whistling duck. They don't make a quack quack. They make a whistle sound, and somewhere after George Lowry's Louisiana Birds 1960 version between the 60 edition and the 74 edition, that species made it to Louisiana. So it's only been there for about the last 50 years and in small numbers. And so if we look back 60 years ago, there was none in Louisiana. So they are expanding in the U.S. So the old name, if you have an old bird book, is black-bellied tree duck. That's the old outdated name. It's now black-bellied whistling duck.
Interesting.
Yeah, cool.
Well, listen. Yeah, I'd like to spot one and like to get my camera out there and shoot one. So, with a film, not the gun. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we have a couple of callers online. And we're going to go next to Valerie from Shreveport, Louisiana. Valerie, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, my question, and I hope it's not too simple. I just want to know, what is the difference between bluebirds and blue jays? And
okay.
Could you describe in appearance, how each one looks?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, Valerie, that's why don't you stay on the line with us? Can you do that, Valerie? You still there? Oh, I guess she jumped off. That's a great question. We don't have a whole lot of birds that are blue in all of the U.S., and especially in our listening area. And she mentioned two of the more common year-round birds that we have. We also have blue grosbeaks and indigo bunnings that are here in the breeding season, but they don't winter with us. But the bluebird has a rusty brownish red breast, and they're small. They're going to be smaller than a cardinal. They're going to be sitting up on a perch usually. They like fence rows. This is the bird that people put boxes up for, nest boxes. They'll use those. But the upper part of the bird is all blue. The wings are blue, but it has a noticeable, again, reddish breast and white belly. So the blue jay is two or three, probably two times larger, has none of that rusty red on it. Instead, he's just blue and white with a little bit of black. And they've got the crest on them. So the blue jay of the two is the only one with a crest, that little top notch that's flaring up off the head. And so they're usually in groups. They're pretty raucous. They're, you know, the blue jays related to crows and ravens and magpies. So they're very social, very vocal, but they're very blue and very beautiful. And I've mentioned this on the radio show before. That's a bird that we take for granted. And that's a bird that doesn't occur in places like California and Oregon. And when those bird watchers come over to Texas or Louisiana and see a blue jay, they're flipping out. Or a British birder, they don't have any blue jays in England. And when those people come over and they see this bright blue and white bird, they flip out. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I guess so. They are beautiful. So we take it for granted. I take it for granted. Maybe not everybody does. But we have both the bluebird and the blue jay in the listening area. And Valerie, thanks for that call. And I hope I summed it up there. They're both, they have blue in common, but not a whole lot else. They're in certainly in attitude and behavior, they're quite different. So thanks for the call, Valerie.
All right. Thank you, Valerie. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist. And we do have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about birding or the avian world is welcome tonight. And we go next to Jason from Lufkin, Texas. Jason, you're on with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Oh, yes, sir. How are you doing, sir? I had a question. I came home from work, and I got out of my car, and I don't want to make the parrot sound, but I believe it is a parrot, and it was up in my tree, and it kept saying hello. Huh. And I didn't know what I need to do. I didn't know if it was a pet. Or what, do I need to feed it, or what?
Yeah.
It would not come down. It's solid white with the black bill, the black beak, and it didn't have no tags on it or nothing like that. So I figured in my neighborhood it got out.
Yeah.
And it just keeps talking to me and stuff like that. But you know.
Yeah. So Jason, you've described an escapee and somebody's probably very upset. And if it's all white, it's one of the cockatoos. And if it talks, that means someone has spent a lot of time with it. But this is the problem. You know, a lot of people like to put the cage out on the porch. And some of these birds are smart enough to open the cage. And then if they're not pinioned, they can fly. So pinion is when you get one of the wings surgically dealt with that the bird can never take full flight. Sometimes people just trim the flight feathers, but guess what? We talked about molt earlier. You just wait a few months, that bird will replace those feathers and all of a sudden can accomplish flight. So someone lost that bird and there's really nothing to do. It's not a wild species. All the cockatoos come from Australia area. And so it's a caged bird. It's unfortunate someone lost it. And I think the best way to catch it is for the owner to come around and have the cage that the bird's familiar with, because that's where food and water, its favorite sleeping perch is. Maybe it would come down to it. But other than that, it's going to be tough to catch a bird like that unless you have a way to lure it with a cage.
Just recommend me putting flyers out and seeing who it belongs to and
What's keeping it from flying to the next neighborhood or flying across town in the next few minutes?
Yeah.
I mean, so the problem with putting up flyers is with something that flies is the flyer, before it gets off of the Xerox machine, that bird's gone. Unless you've seen it in the tree for days and it hasn't moved, then I would do the flyer thing. But you got to be careful because someone that knows that the bird's valuable will say, oh yeah, that's my bird. Here I come. But I think the true owner is going to have the things that can bring the things that the bird's most familiar with. Again, its cage with its favorite feeding dish and whatever favorite food it has, that's going to be the best way to catch it. Now, if that bird doesn't eat, in about 3 or 4 days, he's toast. If he doesn't know about Cooper's hawks that we talked about earlier or other raptors, he's toast.
Do you recommend me? I have cages at the house, cages, but like kennels, you know, for animals, not the plastic ones, but the black ones. Do you recommend me opening one of those up and putting food, bird food, and water in one of those?
If you think he can see it, if I'm envisioning a typical dog or cat kennel, it has pretty solid walls with some slats for airflow, but it doesn't allow anything to really look in from up in the trees. So that's why a parrot cage, you can see that at every angle and at most distances, no matter how tall the tree is, that's going to be the difference. So I don't know what to tell you.
You're good, bud. You're good. I park right underneath the tree, and he can see, he can see me from the top, and I can put the kennel, the cage, it has a slats, and I can put it on top of the hood and then put some bird food and water in it and just see what happens. And
put some on top of the cage, too. Maybe he'll see it even better. I would say a cup of sunflower seeds, some peanuts. Unsalted, not roasted, just raw peanuts in the shell. They'll see that from afar. They'll also eat fruit, maybe put some apple slices, some orange slices. The things that you shouldn't ever give a parrot, there are a couple things are chocolate and avocado. Those are some no-nos. They'll eat just about everything else. I mean, some parrots will eat rice and pasta and scraps of what people are eating at dinner, just like the dog does. But I think you can't go wrong with a cup of sunflower seed and some peanuts and see if he'll come down for that.
Okay. Yes, sir. Thank you so much for your help.
Cool. All right, Jason. And once you catch them, then you can put the flyers up because, people spend a lot of time, you know, with them. And somebody loves that bird, I bet, and wants it back.
Yes, sir. That's why I called, because I just needed your help and your opinion and stuff like that. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And probably a good person, because if you think about it, the bird's saying good, helpful things like hello and not four-letter dirty words like some bad owners teach their parrot. So that's pretty good. You don't have anybody yelling cuss words in your trees, because then you got the neighbors thinking it's you and they're calling the cops, aren't they?
Because when I got out, he said it like 3 or 4 times, like, are you talking to me, God?
Yeah.
And I looked up and then I saw him, and then that was it. But I'll do exactly what you tell me to do, and I'll try to make it work. Thank you so much, sir.
And Jason, if you're successful, call us back in a month or two and give us an update if you've got something to tell us.
Oh, yes, sir. Absolutely.
That'd be cool. We'd like to hear if there's a happy ending to this or if the bird flew off. So,
and Jason, I'd love to hear this bird talk to you. Send a recording.
I'll send a recording. I left to go get some bird food and stuff like that. But I'm heading back, and I'm pretty sure he'll still be back there, but if he's still there, then I'll send the recording. Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Great.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thanks, Jason.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And once again, if you have any photos that you would like Cliff to identify, either during this show, although we're running out of time, but for the next show, or recordings, you can send them to my email address at wbeckett, That's WBECKETT at lsus.edu. lsus.edu. And we have Charles from Shreveport is on next with Cliff. Charles, what's your question tonight?
Well, I was listening to Red River Radio. I can't remember if it was earlier this week or toward the end of last week, and I thought I heard Gary Joyner say he had an app that he could record a bird call and compare it or something.
I hear
birds in the backyard, and I'm like, I wonder what that is, and I have no clue how to start trying to identify them.
Yeah, Gary was promoting a really good app called Song Sleuth, S-L-E-U-T-H. It's available. I don't know how much it costs. I don't think that one's free. It might be, but it still has some quirks. It's not spot on. It will sometimes, and I think Gary mentioned that, it'll give you, it'll narrow all the field down to maybe the top two or three species, and then you got to go from there. So Song Sleuth, that's the app to you'll record it. And it will, it's kind of like the one for music called Shazam. For anybody that's really into music, gosh, I love Shazam, because if I hear something really cool on the radio that I've never heard before and I really like, or I've forgotten who it is because it's been 20 years, Shazam will identify within seconds what that song is. So Song Sleuth is a little tougher because you know, the studio recording of any Rolling Stone song is never going to change. But what we have with birds is something called dialect. It's right. Just like humans. So when you travel around the country, some birds just sound a little bit different depending on where you are in the country. And it's the same thing with the humans around. You know, you and I, you're in Shreveport. When you travel up to New York, people just sound different. Same thing with birds. So there's local dialects, regional dialects that Song Sleuth has to deal with. And I think that makes it a lot more challenging than Shazam.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I've got my grandson staying with us during the day some right now, and he's 5 and he just loves birds. And
cool.
We look at the birds in the backyard, and we've got a couple bird books, and he'll look through there, and he says, "This is what we saw, isn't it?" And I said, yes, that's right. And then he'll hear them, and the ones that I don't know, I'm like, well, I wish I could tell you, but I don't have a clue.
Yeah. Another app, Charles, that you might introduce to him is one that's free called Merlin, M-E-R-L-I-N, M-E-R-L-I-N, Merlin. It's by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And it's a cool app. It'll ask you, it first asks you, where are you? Because location matters. And then it will ask you a couple of questions about the bird you're seeing. And that's something fun that you and he can do, answer those questions. And then kind of like Song Sleuth, it'll say, well, it could be one of these few species. And it makes it really fun because it's not giving you the answer necessarily. It's kind of narrowing it down. You get to do the rest. But when you're dealing with hundreds of species and you're unfamiliar with them, it at least narrows the field down considerably. So try Song Sleuth and Merlin, and I think you guys will have a lot of fun playing with that with your backyard birds. Okay, Charles?
All right. Yeah. Now, my oldest son has told me about, I think, one by Audubon that would help you narrow down searching to figure out what bird it is.
Yep. Audubon has, that's, yeah, and I really like the Merlin app for that. I do like Audubon's app as well, but Merlin does a very good job of asking you specific questions and narrows it down, and it also has gone more global. You can use that in other countries now, and it's expanding. So really helpful when you're going to unfamiliar turf with unfamiliar birds.
Okay, well, great. I appreciate it.
Cool. Yep. Thanks, Charles.
And speaking of different identifiers, I've got Merlin on my computer and the Audubon one, and I'm looking at Song Sleuth right now. I've got an Android phone, and it gives it 2.6 stars out of 5. But there are other ones on here like World Bird Sounds and Birdsong ID USA. that have, you know, 4.1 to 5 recognition. Bird call sounds and ringtones is interesting, but I think that's ringtones.
Yeah, that's not what we're talking about.
Are there
about.
Any of these other ones that you think would be a good thing for a, you know, a burgeoning birder to go ahead and purchase? Or in this case, the Android, they're all free.
Is SongSleuth free?
Yeah, because it comes with ads, so you have to put up with the ads.
Oh, I see.
You know,
okay. Yeah, some of those other apps don't have all the birds in their database. So I've seen some of those where it's just maybe a tenth of the birds in the country, and so it's very limited. So that's going to be an issue. Make sure that you're getting one that's very complete and all-inclusive, because you don't want to have one that's just, you know, gets you 10% of the way there.
Okay. That's interesting interesting information. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And we have about 5 minutes left before we'll be going to our conservation tip. So if you have any call right now, the lines are all open. Please get it in right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And, well, Troy kind of wrote in here in our little chat box that he read an article from the Palm Beach Post about a parrot that was calling out, "Let me out, let me out." And the cries prompted the neighbors to call 911, and police visited the man's house. Have you heard of that story?
No, that doesn't surprise me. That's pretty funny. So, yeah, there's some pretty incredible examples of parrots that are imitating and sound just like a human. So, yeah, another reason not to teach your parrot cuss words, because because
especially
a lot of people like
around the grandkids or grandma.
Yeah, yeah. And on a nice weather day, sometimes people move the cage out on the porch. Clearly, that's what happened to this one in Florida, unless the windows were open. But typically people can move the cage out, and the screen and porch is a great time for a parrot to get some fresh air. But if he's yelling out things like, "Let me out," yeah, I can see why someone called 911, because that's a cry of help and you don't know. But funny ending and good thing no one was hurt. But, yeah, interesting.
Hey, Cliff. Hey Cliff, this is Troy.
Okay, go ahead.
Hey, Cliff, I have a question for you.
Sure.
So my uncle decided to put up boxes in his backyard for wood ducks, right? And so he's gotten wood ducks that come back there, and there's about four or five of them that visit so often. But he's also attracted a family of hawks. So there's a couple of hawks that are looking for these wood ducks. And he's found the pile of feathers already. So the question begs, how can he protect the wood ducks that he likes to see in his backyard away from those hawks legally?
Yeah. Well,
legally again.
Right. Well, the thing is, you have to let nature take its course. And so hawks and ducks have been together for millennia. So there's really nothing you can do. You can't cut all the trees down that the hawks are perching in. That's ridiculous. They'll sit on the rooftop. Well, then you can't level all the houses. So it's just not possible. So what you have to do is hope that the ducks are savvy. You hope the ducks are truly wild and are wary and can take care of their own. And that's really all he can do. So it's different than if you raise chickens. So if you're putting out wood duck boxes, those are for wild ducks. But if you have chickens and you want to have free range chickens, you better be prepared that you all of a sudden, everything that likes to eat chicken, from foxes to hawks, to coons, to the neighbor's dogs, are going to be after your chickens. So you want to keep your chickens in a cage with a roof on it so these predators can't get to your chickens. But back to your wood ducks, there's really nothing you can do except, again, hope that these ducks are taking care of themselves.
Thanks, Cliff.
Yeah, thanks, Troy.
And we've got two more callers online, Cliff, so we're going to have to get to these quickly. Yep. Barry from Shreveport, you are on with Cliff. What's your question?
Oh, thank you. I just have a quick question. Are there any plans of restoring quail on the Red River?
Okay. Well, that's going to be a very costly task. Restoring quail, we could spend an hour on that topic. And we have mentioned it before. I do like bringing it up again. I'm glad you did bring it up, Barry. But I think in that because we're short on time, I won't be able to mention that it's quite a heavy load to bring quail back. And let me make a statement that pen-raised quail don't do well in the field as reestablishing with pen-raised birds. Those are usually dumb as can be. They get out there and they have a lifespan of maybe 2 or 3 weeks because they haven't figured out how to be wild and wary. So don't think that buying pen-raised quail is a way to reintroduce that. It just doesn't work. So habitat is the issue. You got to get the habitat back, and we will have to talk about the ins and outs of that at a later date, Barry. But that's a very good question, and I thank you for the call.
Thank you.
All right, and we're going to go. We've got two more callers online. Troy, I'm going to Randy next. Randy is on 320, line 320. Randy, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Hey, Cliff, I've got a quick question. I've asked you this before. I live on Cross Lake, and the Purple Martins take up residence in the boathouse every year, and they love it, but it's a high-maintenance issue, as you would expect. And a friend of mine said that if I put alligator heads, like the real ones that you would buy like at Bass Pro Shop or maybe Cracker Barrel, would scare them away and I wouldn't have to do anything else. Do you have any way of validating that theory?
I think this is kind of like the elixir guy that used to come around 100 years ago and tell you that the elixir he's selling is going to kill the cancer and everything else that ails you. So no, I don't think that's a good fix at all, Randy. And I would, I don't know what to tell you, but I wouldn't do that. You could try it, prove me wrong, but those kinds of things are static. They don't move. Birds figure it out pretty quick that it's just ornamental. So I don't think that's going to help you at all.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Cool.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Randy.
I'm having visions of the outlaw Josie Wales and a scene from that right now. So it works with miracles on anything. How is it with stains?
Yeah, right.
We've got one more caller online. We've got to get to quick. Karen from Tyler, you're on with Cliff. What's your question?
Yes, I saw a mourning dove feeding two smaller doves, and all the birds were on the ground. And so it caused me to wonder, how long will a mother bird feed the younger chicks? I guess, you know, I've not birded very long, so I'm used to thinking of them feeding them when they're in the nest. So I was just wondering.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's different with each species, but I was just curious about that.
Right. It is different with each species. Some birds can spend up to 10 or 12 months being fed. Some of your larger raptors might go that long or even longer being fed by the young, by the adults. But your mourning dove, he and she are going to feed those young for probably a few weeks. And while they're doing that, the young are watching the adults. How did they do that? They're bringing me food. That's how they learn how to be mourning doves. That's how they learn how to feed on their own. They're flying with mom, they're begging, but they're also watching and paying attention on how to capture food on their own. So she'll do that for a while, but not for months. Mm-hmm. And but the larger birds, like a harpy eagle in the tropics, sometimes those birds will have to breed every other year, some of them, because of these species, because the young beg so long and take so long to grow up that they require much more effort. But the mourning dove, not much effort. So I would think after a few weeks, she'll be done. And during that few weeks, that she's going to be feeding less and less as those birds, young birds, learn how to feed themselves.
Okay, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Karen.
All right. Thank you, Karen. And let's go to our conservation tip for this week. Cliff, what do you have for us?
Yep. This, believe it or not, this is our 50th conservation tip, 5-0. And it's titled Seeing the Forest for the Trees. We all get upset when we see an injured or dead bird, especially when it is the result of human actions like getting hit by a car or flying into a window. Most of us will try very hard to help that injured animal by contacting a certified rehabber, as we should. Sometimes we get so focused on the trees that we fail to see the forest. What I mean is, as individuals and as a society, we make decisions every day that severely impact hundreds, thousands, or even millions of birds and other wildlife. Decisions like clearing land for development or pastures planted in non-native grass, building houses or offices with highly reflective windows, overwatering our lawns, driving gas-guzzling vehicles, and even letting our pet cats roam outside. We aren't intending to injure wildlife by doing these things. It's what biologists refer to as incidental take, or the military refers to as collateral damage. There's a reason that we have seen a national decline of 3 billion birds, as cited in an article published in September 2019 in the journal Science. While some of these larger scale activities are unavoidable, some are within our control. Consider energy efficient appliances, planting native plants to offset our turf lawns, contributing money to organizations that conserve land and birds, and contacting your elected officials when you see actions or policy decisions you know will impact our native wildlife negatively. Sometimes all the bad news in the world can make us feel like our small actions will never make a difference, but they will do it for the birds.
All right, and we're running a little late. You have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and he is the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department ornithologist there. Tonight's program was made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. And we'd like to thank everybody for calling in tonight. The sound files for tonight's program were provided by, and I got to look that up, by Mick Reiger and also Thomas Graves. And our photo tonight was by James Childress. And we want to thank both of them for contributing to this show. The next edition of What's Bugging You is coming up next Tuesday night at 6 o'clock. And the next edition of Bird Calls will be on August 11th. This is Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, KLDN, Lufkin, Nacogdoches, KLSA, Alexandria, Pineville, and KTYK, Overton, Tyler, Kilgore. And stay tuned, Radio Lab is next.